Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Well, what most people know about California, people who don't live there, are the cliches: earthquakes, wildfires, sunshine, and of course, movie stars. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580, journalist Mark Arix, has lived in California all of his life. He's former reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's the author of a book that we'll be talking about this morning, and the title is West of the West, the subtitle Dreamers, Believers, Builders, and Killers in the Golden State. It's published by Public Affairs. And it's a product of the reporting that he did when he was working for the paper and his desire perhaps to go back to touch base again with some of the places and the people that he wrote about and write about them in a way where he has greater time and space to give to the story. And he says when it comes to those cliches, those were things that he really wanted to avoid. And what he wants to do is get across the idea that California is really a very complex place. There are different and very distinct regions that give those regions a particular character. And all those things he writes about in the book. He says every part of the state has its own personality and it gives rise to its own kind of drama. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, your questions, of course, are welcome. The only thing we ask of people is that you just keep questions brief, questions and comments brief, so we can keep moving along. But folks certainly are welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you certainly can call. Questions are welcome. Mark Arix, hello.
Thanks good morning.
Thanks.
Well, it's good morning for me. I guess it's good afternoon for you guys.
It's still morning, so yeah. We still got a little bit of a morning to go. I'm glad you could give us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And one of the things I guess I was thinking about in getting ready to talk with you, one of the things that I did was I listened to an interview that you did with a public station there in California, and the people who were calling in, they were all Californians, and I'm thinking, well, gosh, you know, people there, they are going to relate to this in a very different way because they're there, and this is about California, and here we are halfway across the country, and how is it I'm going to be able to get people to really grab onto the story, which is so much about California?
Well, it's funny. I don't think the Californians really know their place either because there are so many distinct places. I happen to be talking to you from the middle of the state. Hmm. This is the San Joaquin Valley, which is part of this great big valley in the middle of the state, and it really has nothing to do with California. I mean, politically, the way it looks, the way it feels, it's more part of the Midwest or the South, and this is the greatest agricultural belt that the world has ever built. 250 crops. There's more milk and more meth, kind of produced by this place than any other place in the country. So it's this agricultural miracle empire, and it's very distinct from Los Angeles and San Francisco and all the way up north to Humboldt, which is its whole other region that has been built on the marijuana plant. So anyhow, it's a very complicated place, this state, and I think what ends up getting communicated to people in the East and the Midwest is the cliches of California, and right now it's the bankruptcy of California is a story that's being told nationally.
That it does really strike me that that's something that maybe people don't appreciate. That certainly you look at California on the map, you see, well, this is a big state, and that's goes without saying. But that you can travel, if you travel, I'm sure, all the way from north to south, you can encounter a lot of different kinds of ecosystems. And in fact, Northern California really is the Pacific, part of the Pacific Northwest, and the South, well, really, you're talking about something that is part of the desert Southwest. And I guess you just have everything in between, maybe it's not quite true to say all the different kind of conditions you could find any place in the United States, but certainly a lot of them, they're all there contained within the same place.
Yeah, there's been this debate that comes up now and again, especially when California is enduring one of its busts, as it is now, that we should divide the state up. It doesn't work as a whole, and they talk about dividing up in two. Well, really, if you're being true to the place, you probably have to divide it up into five. It's that massive and that distinct. So what I try to do is I know the middle of this state very well. I grew up here. My family, for you know, three generations, they were farmers here. And then my dad, then they went to the grocery business. And then my dad ended up buying a nightclub when I was a kid. And he ended up getting murdered in that nightclub. And that was my first book, the story of my father's murder, my family's journey from, you know, Armenia west. And it was a murder that was never solved. And so in the last story of this book, West of the West, the murder 30 years later gets solved by this very strange set of coincidences. So there, in all of my books, I try to tell a story of place. Place becomes, I don't think you can be a writer in the West and not account for place as a character.
Hmm. Maybe I should just quickly again introduce the guest, Mark Arox. He's written two previous books, The King of California, which was an L.A. Times bestseller and best book of the year, and the one that he just mentioned, that's In My Father's Name. He's contributing writer at L.A. Magazine, former senior writer for the Los Angeles Times. He's taught nonfiction writing at Claremont McKenna College, makes his home in Fresno, and is the author of this new book, West of the West, which is a collection of essays about California, a lot of them really growing out of reporting that he did when he was working for the Times. Public Affairs is the publisher. And questions, again, here are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm also interested in your reflections about the title. I think that it's interesting that the title of the book comes from something that Teddy Roosevelt said when he was visiting California, and this was 1905, and he said, "When I'm in California, I'm not in the West. I am west of the West." And that certainly suggests that even at that time, people thought about California as being someplace that was on the edge, and I mean, yeah, in the metaphor, in both in the literal and metaphorical sense.
No, I think we obviously occupy the the continent's edge. So geographically, it's at the edge; it's its own place. And I think there's a psychological space that we occupy that's also at the edge. This might sound a tad bit facile, but one of the things that I feel pretty strongly about is that California isn't really a state. It's not even a region. It's kind of America before the rest of America figures it out. And I think that has to do with our willingness to experiment and occupy a kind of strange edge as well. And I think this state is still kind to that extreme, those extreme experiments. And I think sometimes those experiments work, and they create, Silicon Valley, for instance. Oftentimes they don't work. And I think this also has to do with the tremendous booms and busts that define California.
As I was thinking about perhaps some of the themes of these stories or what holds this together, one thing that occurred to me is that maybe more than other places, and this is probably part of our American myth, but I think it may be more true of California than maybe any place else. There is this almost unreserved faith in, belief in, enthusiasm for growth.
Yes.
And I think about, some of the various conversations I've had here with various people about the mortgage crisis.
Yep.
And about one of the basic ideas underlying the mortgage crisis was this faith that land never loses value, that it's always going to go up.
That's right.
And it strikes me that in a way that's part of the story of California, and that is the idea that everything always goes up.
Well, it's a great question, and it's one of the questions I tackle in the first piece, which is kind of a roaming piece where I'm roaming around the state. If you look at this foreclosure crisis, where it has hit the hardest, there are some communities that maybe even your listeners don't really know about. Stockton, Merced, Modesto, Fresno. These are cities in the middle of the state where there was in this farm belt, this incredible farm belt, and these cities are being the farmland is being paved over in a way very much like L.A. was paved over in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and there's just this there was a crazy boom mentality that kind of led the nation in that housing boom. So these towns, the values of the houses rose higher as a percentage than any other place in the country. So it just stood to reason that when the bust came, they have fallen deeper into this kind of descent than any other place in the country. And the foreclosure crisis is playing out in a very kind of ugly way in the middle of the state. When I started this book, it was actually at the tail end of the boom. And in this valley, developers who were paving over farmland, they were buying the farmland basically for $100,000 an acre, and then planting houses that they were selling for six, seven, eight times that much. But they were making a 50% profit. That's pure profit on every home they were building. That's an unheard of profit margin in the housing building industry anywhere in the country. If you're making 10-12% a house, you're making a very, very nice, if not lusty, kind of profit. So here there was that greed that played out nationwide that got us into trouble. That greed was operating at a very, very high level, and it was led by a bank that was underwriting most of it out here called Countrywide Financial in Southern California. Well, they were also underwriting loans throughout the nation. And if you trace this foreclosure crisis, you will trace it right back to California and Countrywide.
Yeah, this was, it was the bank that was read, was run by the famous, now infamous, Angelo Mozzillo.
That's right.
He was quite the character.
Oh, yes. I don't think anybody really has ever, I've seen some pieces about him, but I don't think anyone has really delved into that place and its culture in quite the way that it should be looked into.
Well, it strikes me, again, having had conversations about this, I'm sure I have asked many times, callers have asked many times at different guests this question, how did this happen? And it's hard to, in one sense, the answer is easy, in the other sense, the answer is complicated. But I wonder to what extent, if you can understand some of this spirit of California, some of this thing that we've been talking about, that might be actually might help you understand a little bit about why exactly this happened.
Well, out here in California, our larger crisis has to do with a couple different things. One, I do think it has to do with our reliance on a boom and bust culture. It's been that way since the beginning, since the gold rush. Okay. Secondly, there has been this, we rely in a disproportionate way, more so than other states, on income tax. See, we had a whole tax revolt here that I'm sure your more learned listeners know about, Prop 13.
Sure.
In the 70s, which basically capped what local governments could collect from property taxes. So, We can't collect the kind of money we want to collect from the housing industry, which means that the housing industry doesn't really pencil out for us. You know, all these homes that are being built, they're basically economic losers. I did a piece once for the LA Times that the building industry did not like it at all, but I took a look at five different cities in California that had gone through this huge boom, and in every instance, these cities, their coffers were worse off during the boom than they had been before the boom. And this seems so counterintuitive. I thought, well, what's going on here? Well, basically, because we were not collecting the kind of property taxes that other states were, we had to collect that money through developer fees. But each of these cities, Each was unwilling to charge developers the kind of fees for infrastructure that they should have been charged. So we weren't getting parks, we weren't getting waterways, streets, we weren't funding our police and fire the way other places were funding them, because we were refusing to collect the required amount of money from developers. And this had to do with developer power in these cities. It had to do with corruption on the part of city officials. And so basically growth was an economic loser. It was kind of a giant Ponzi scheme. And this is before Madoff. We had this huge Ponzi scheme going on in California where they kept approving residential subdivisions that were economic losers to pay for the economic losing subdivision that went in before it. And at some point, you can only sustain that kind of treadmill, and then all of a sudden it just collapses. And so that is at the heart of our collapse here. That was the Ponzi scheme. And I look at it, in kind of a deep manner in one of the chapters in this West of the West.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers. We'll bring them into the conversation here. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. That's for anybody for whom it would be long-distance calls, including this caller here on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, thanks, Dave. I got a question, though. I don't know if you're familiar with Lancaster at all. Are you?
Oh, yes, I am.
Yeah, well, I grew up out there. That's where I was born and raised. And, in fact, I'm out here now. I think I've been out here for about 20 years. And the system's totally different. But I remember when I left there in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, it hadn't blown out of proportion like it is now. There are so many people and so many foreclosures. Most of my family still lives out there, and it's a mess. I mean, it used to be a really nice town. Unfortunately, because of the overbuilding like you're talking about,
Yeah. They've
gotten, you know, crazy. If you look at Valencia and how they've shaved down the mountaintops, and people think, I'm full of, baloney when I tell them this, but they're literally taking mountains apart to put subdivisions in. And, you know, when you start doing that as a perspective, as a contractor, there's a lot of things that are involved in there, a lot of the runoff and, that they have to deal with, a lot of the engineering and the infrastructure aspects of it. It seems like they get put aside or allowed, like you say, a lot of this stuff was allowed and it shouldn't have been.
No, I think that's another place that is very much like the middle of California where I'm at. We don't seem out here in the West to be able to draw a line around a place and basically say that, okay, on this side of the line, we're going to preserve what's there, this incredible soil that produces, 250 crops, many of them you can't grow anywhere else in America. And then on the other side of the line, we're going to build up. We're going to start building up and making cities real cities. And so that L.A. Model of growth, which is essentially sprawl, has, you would think the rest of California would look to L.A. and say, well, that experiment really didn't quite work. Why are we transporting it to our place? And yet it that logic does not hold. And so you're seeing the swallowing up of this wonderful farmland. And
I think that's a good example of something that's bad example, I guess, or a good example of things gone awry. And they started doing it out here, though. I mean, I'm out in the sticks. I live actually in the town of Geneva, which is just between St. Charles and Batavia. But I used to live down south, too, down towards Champaign-Urbana. And I'm watching these farm fields being swallowed up. And part of the reason, and I asked the farmer why, he said it cost him too much in taxes. He said it's better for me to just go ahead and sell off everything for housing developments and get killed from the property tax issue. And, this state has a problem. This is the one thing good about California, I'll say, is that Proposition 13, until we get our act together and do that kind of stuff, it makes it unaffordable for anybody in this state to make a living and to live in their house. I mean, the property tax...
Well, don't wish too hard for that, because Prop 13 is at the heart of some of our economic problems here, because we're relying so much on income, the income tax to kind of pay for our infrastructure. But when you talk to the farmer here, and this is an interesting farm belt. We have the biggest farmers in the world are here in the middle of California. These are men who own 140,000 acres of land, and they're the biggest growers of almonds and pistachios and pomegranates in the world. Okay, but when you talk to them, the smaller farmer, and which is becoming less and less sustainable a proposition. You know, let's say a guy who's growing plums, okay? His father was selling plums for $6 a box in 1980. Today, that farmer is selling plums for the same $6 a box. So there's this problem underlying it. It has to do with, you know, big grocery chains and people, you know, unwilling to pay, you know, what they maybe should pay for their produce and fruit. And so this is acting as obviously an incentive to pave over the land, to sell out. I mean, you know, a farmer works most of his life here, the smaller farmer, for that day where the developer comes and knocks on his door.
You know, we were talking earlier about my thinking about how it is that maybe I could get people here to relate to California. And one of the things that it strikes me about a lot of the stories in your book, interestingly enough, is that one way or another that they have to do with agriculture. And I don't know that we really think here that we really think so much about California as being a farm state.
No,
but it is.
No, it's you know, we're talking about a 350 to 400 mile middle, along a highway called 99, and this is a singular place in the American landscape, the Central Valley, the Big Valley of California. This is where Steinbeck's Okies came. Okay, this is where all these immigrant groups who have a real attachment to the land came. Let me give you one little story. I was driving along Highway 99, and I've driven this road countless times. And I looked over to the side of the road near a town called Pixley one day, and I saw this shack that looked like it had been lifted out of the 1930s Mississippi Delta. And I thought, my God, I've never seen that shack before. You know, thank goodness no one lives there. And then it was a winter day, I could see smoke coming out of this little stove pipe in the roof. So I said, someone is living there. Who is that? So I pulled off the road, crossed the railroad tracks, went into a vineyard where grapes were, walked up to this house. It was on stilts, and I knocked on the door once, twice, three times, and then out came this man, this black man, who looked like he had been lifted out of the 1930s Mississippi Delta. He had a stutter and a Louisiana drawl, and he started telling me his story of how he had followed the cotton trail from Louisiana all the way west to the San Joaquin Valley. And I said, my God, is there anybody else like you here? And he says, oh, on the other side of the road, there's a whole community of us. So I went there, and I spent 2 days talking to these black families who had done something that no black families in America had done. They had, you know, that tremendous migration from the South to the industrial cities of the North, you know, where your region. Mm. Well, that was black families going from the rural to the urban. And they did the same thing here in California. They went from the rural to Oakland and L.A. And yet there was this tribe, if you will, of black folks who believed so strongly in the rural ethic that they went from rural South to rural West. And there I found them more than a half a century later. They were no longer working in the cotton fields because the machine had now taken over. And yet they were living in these little patches of alkali. And when I say alkali, the land was white as snow. And they had been locked out of these cities by racism. And there they existed. I remember calling up my editor at the LA Times and saying, I've found a tribe of black Okies that Steinbeck never wrote about. And they're a lost tribe in the middle of California. I remember my editor being so fascinated, he gave me a year to capture their culture and their voices. And that was the go-go days of the LA Times.
Yeah.
I went back in this book to find them 10 years later, and they're all gone. So thank goodness I captured those voices, because they were unique voices in Americana.
Our guest is Mark Arax. If you go looking for his book, his last name is spelled A-R-A-X. He's the author of the books King of California, In My Father's Name, and his newest, it's West of the West, and it's published by Public Affairs. He's contributing editor at the Los Angeles Magazine, former senior writer at the LA Times. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. We have some other callers here we'll get to. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Champagne is next. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It may or may not happen in our lifetimes, but there's a chance it will sooner or later, that there will be a great crashing wave of migration coming from the west to the east due entirely to, and I hope you can speak about this, the limitations of water.
Yes.
I know water has always been a problem in Southern California, and of course, you know, as an example, Las Vegas is draining Lake Mead faster than it's refilling, and it's thought that has to do with the reduced snow runoff and things like that in the mountains. And I know Northern California hasn't worried about that so much, but I've just heard of late that even in Oregon and Washington, they're getting to be a bit concerned because there's the reduced runoff in the mountains and so on and so forth. So if you would please talk about the water, which I think will sooner or later will make things absolutely stop and probably cause a reverse migration just because there just ain't enough to drink. And, you know, you can do without food for a while, but you got to have water every day.
It's an excellent question when it comes to the West. You know, one of the great white writers of America was a man named Stegner. And Stegner kept talking about how the arid West, that one day we would not be able to defy that. We've been able to defy it so far, and it may be that day is coming. Let me tell you a little bit about just some of the water and the way it's wheeled around this state. Okay, we have a state of California where four-fifths of the water, the rainwater, drops where maybe one-fifth of the population lives. And then we have four-fifths of the population living in desert climes. So there's just an illogic at the heart of the way we've developed the West. So what happens is where I live, for instance, it only rains 6, 7, 8 inches a year, and yet it's this agricultural miracle. So how does that happen? Well, it happens because we happen to sit in a valley at the foot of the Sierra Mountains, and the Sierra Mountains, before the days of global warming and still today, that's a huge, huge reservoir of water that gets up there in the snow melt. And every spring, that snow melt comes down. And agriculture has basically captured every river coming out of the Sierra. And not just captured it 40, 50% of its flow, but, for instance, the San Joaquin River near my house, 98% of its flow has been captured in the name of agriculture. And it's shunted west, it's shunted east, it's shunted south by this lattice work of canals and things. So a tremendous amount of engineering has occurred over this past century to make this farmland boom. And now that engineering is being used to take that farm water, and some of the farmers are now shipping it to cities. So what's going to happen is as that snow melt lessens, and it has lessened, we were in a drought again, that fight becomes it can become very ugly between farms and cities and the environment. And right now in the middle of California, the fight is happening, and it's being billed as a fight between the fish and farms. It's not quite that simple. So yes, I think at some point, it may not be in our lifetimes, but water will be the constraint on growth that we don't seem to be able to constrain ourselves, and I think water will be that constraint. And one of two things is going to happen. Either all the water that's going to the farmland is going to go to cities, and so our farms are going to dry up, or the farms are going to maintain, and the cities then will have to stop growing in the way they have, and then all that migration that's come into California may end up coming your way. And it already has. I mean, let's look at America over the last 20 years. The Latino population, that those migrants from Mexico, they used to be, you know, only in the Southwest and the West. I go back to some of the places. I went to Columbia University in New York. in the 80s, you couldn't find a good Mexican restaurant in New York. Today, there are Mexican restaurants everywhere. So that migration out of Mexico has now affected all of America, not just the pockets that it traditionally affected.
All right, let's talk with someone else. Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hi. As usual, you're evoking so much, but if I have the place where you are in my mind correctly, the irony is that you're also susceptible to a chance of a massive flood problem, right? Isn't that the area built up with levees and...
You got a pretty good sense of the topography, geography of California. I'm about 150 miles south of that delta where the levees, where the Chinese immigrants in the last century built this. It's a stunning, stunning piece of engineering. These levees that kept the San Francisco Bay from intruding inland with its salt water. And you're right, an earthquake, if it took out that levee system, it could take out, 2/3 of California's waterworks.
Well, I understood that even unexpected torrential rain event could possibly... Anyway, there are so many complexities. What about Reagan's ditch? I mean, actually, isn't urban reality and demands on water are competing with the agricultural? It's not just the fish and the... And the farmers that are competing, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, you know, when you look at LA, you look at a city that's built on imported and some would say stolen water. What you're going to see is three entities kind of competing: the environment, the need to keep water in those rivers for fish. The farms, the need to siphon that water for growing all these crops, and then the cities. And the thing about cities is, once you build those houses, the spigot's not going to go dry. It never has. So ultimately, it will be the cities that will win out in these water wars. And I think that's where it's headed.
Mm. If I might have one more, and it's a bit digressive, but can you? The author that I look at, and I haven't but read his magazine articles, is City of Quartz author Mike Davis. I'm wondering whether you're collegial with it and how your work supplements. You seem like you're looking more at the rural areas than he. And then there's just one other real aside, which is I listen to Santa Monica radio quite a bit because there's so much good stuff there. But I heard an announcement about some kind of nuclear accident in Chatsworth. It's not getting into at least not the press that I'm looking at here in the rest of the country. Do you have anything on that little detail?
Mike Davis and I are friends. I think Mike's style is different than mine. I really delve deeply into land and people. And in this book, I'm all over the state, urban and rural. And I really I try to tell these dramas, these stories. I mean, in some cases, they're dramas about immigrant families where a murder-suicide at the heart of the family. And I just delve deep into that story. Other times, it's the incredible marijuana. Hopefully, we can talk about that before this hour is up, of Humboldt. And then I look at really the summer of love in 67, Berkeley, San Francisco, and how that cultural battle continues to be played today. So Davis, Davis is a tremendous voice out here, but I think he sometimes brings a polemicist's bent to his stuff, and I try to let the stories kind of, rise up in maybe a little more natural way. His stuff is very powerful, having said that. Chatsworth, I don't know what you're talking about. There was some nuclear experiments going on for the defense industry in Chatsworth in the 50s and 60s. And there were some spills that happened, and these spills were covered up. And about 5-6 years ago, some students and professors at UCLA began looking into these spills. And in fact, it's very interesting you ask, because I was going to, one of the stories I was going to delve into for this book, West of the West, was that story. But I couldn't, I needed more time to do it. So I think that's what you're talking about. It's a story that I think someone should go back and look at, because it has to do with that whole era of the 50s and 60s and the nuclear race and the secret experiments that were going on in Chatsworth, I believe.
Hmm. Well, we have about 20 minutes left, or actually maybe more, about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Mark Arix. He's a former reporter for the LA Times and is author of the book West of the West. It's a collection of essays about people and places that he has known and written about. It's published by Public Affairs. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, we've been talking on and off about agriculture and about how it is important in the state of California and how a lot of these stories are about agriculture. So let's talk about Northern California and marijuana. You said you'd like to talk about Humboldt.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say what I do is I go into these different places, and like you said at the outset, and I believe that each of the landscapes of California produces, you know, by virtue of their own history, psychology, and then geography, they produce their own dramas. So I'm looking to tell dramas that play out on the land. And it bothers me that people want to pigeonhole a book as a California book or even a West book. To me, they're just great stories that come out of the soil of America. Okay, they just happen to be taking place in the geographical confines of California. So what I did is I went up to Humboldt, which is, let's say, the top fifth of California. I had some familiarity with it, but I really, really never had dug in. I decided to go up there and see for myself this nation that was built on marijuana. And it really stunned me how reliant the top fifth of California is on marijuana. And it dwarfs, if you want to consider it agriculture, it dwarfs all the other agricultural regions of California and America. These are huge, huge marijuana plantations that have been grown up there. And it's just kind of a lawless place. And so I drove for a couple hundred miles, and literally every business I came across was either wholly reliant on marijuana because it was selling, let's say, all the fertilizers that marijuana would need, all the lights, all the housing supplies and things like that the gardens would need. Or it was just one step away from, you know, the restaurants, everything were obviously benefiting from the money. And I stepped into a very fascinating cultural clash, and I'll tell you guys about it a little bit. In the Summer of Love out of Berkeley in San Francisco in 67, a lot of the hippies couldn't afford the rents after that Summer of Love. They couldn't afford the rents of San Francisco and Berkeley. So they moved north to these Redwood Mountains. Okay, and they took with them the marijuana plant. And the locals, you know, disdained these hippies, okay, the rednecks, if you will, the hillbillies, looked and said, you know, who are these people invading our mountain and bringing with them not only their crazy politics, but this plant? So there was a lot of tension between the hippies and the rednecks. Well, what happened is the kids of the hippies and the kids of the rednecks went to school together, and some of them fell in love. And so when I went up to Humboldt, I found a very kind of strange animal roaming the land. It was the redneck hippie, okay? And the redneck hippie is someone who listens to Bob Marley, has long Rastafarian hair, tattoos, drives these muscular cars, and believes that, you know, the greatest president in U.S. history was George W. Bush. So they've got, and they're also these huge marijuana growers. They're growing marijuana in a different way, these redneck hippies, than the old hippies. The old hippies grew it out in the sun in kind of small organic ways. These guys have gone into those pristine mountains. They've built these huge structures. And they're growing the marijuana inside. That way they can control the environment more. They can get four harvests instead of one. And they can produce a bud that's much more powerful than the old bud. The problem is this. They're using to lights, and to generate the power of those lights, they're using diesel. And the diesel is spilling into the creeks. And so I walked into a meeting, just, kind of happenstance. Got lucky. In a place called Garberville, where the old hippies were rising up in protest against the new hippies over their pollution pot, diesel dope. And so there was this fascinating culture clash across a generation where the the two, you know, the folks that taught that place how to grow marijuana was now protesting the industrial way that marijuana was grown.
You know, just to take it in a little bit different direction here in our last, maybe we've got about 10 minutes. You say that although the book, The West of the West, is not intended to be a memoir, your personal story and some of the story of your family here is part of this. And it seems that when you talk about how your grandfather came here from Armenia, lured here by stories that it was the sort of the classic golden land of opportunity stories, and that the family did do well, that seems that this is a classic immigrant story, at least sort of the classic 19th century version of this story. And what you're trying to do, as well as tell a little bit of that story, is connect to the immigrant story of today and talk about how, in some ways, maybe the experiences are the same, but in very fundamental ways, the experiences are very different.
Yeah, what holds these pieces together is not just the kind of the shared culture of California and the landscape, but it's really my own personal story. So in a way, I wanted it both ways. I wanted to be able to really dig in and tell nonfiction in a way that, you know, at least out here hasn't been told since Joan Didion did it. But I also wanted to tell my own family story. I wanted to work from the center out, the center of California out to its extremes, the center of my own family's narrative out to other family narratives. My grandfather was a survivor of the Armenian Genocide. Okay, he hid in an attic for a year. He wanted to be a poet. He was living in Istanbul, Turkey at the time. He was headed to the Sorbonne in Paris. This uncle, whose family had been wiped out in the genocide, had moved to Fresno, California. And he was writing my grandfather from Fresno to Istanbul, telling him, "You must come here. This is a new Armenia. The grapes are as big as jade eggs. The watermelons are like small boats." And my grandfather, at the age of 1920, took this bait, and he arrived here in California. And, he did what all young poets do when they arrive in California. I got on my hands and knees and started picking potatoes. So his story was of a migrant fruit picker who ended up pooling enough money with his family to buy their first farm. And my father was born in that farm in the 1930s. I went back to my grandfather's, the first places he had worked in America, and I walked into the very field that he worked. This is 85 years later for this book, and there were footsteps leading into that field. And I walked in deep in, and there at the end of the row was a young woman from Oaxaca. The Oaxaca was turning to dust. Another dust bowl was driving people to California. And I asked her, you know, how she got here. She got here in the back of a Suburban. She was smuggled by a trafficker of humanity known as a coyote. And she was paying off her debt to the coyote by working. And really the thing that brought her here was the same thing that brought my grandfather, just this notion of being able to start over again in California. And it was the land that drew her here. And so when I looked at her footsteps, I almost saw my grandfather's. And I spent time with those Oaxacans a year. I do a story called The Summer of the Death of Hilario Guzman, where I follow one family for a year from raisin harvest to raisin harvest. And it's really one of the most intimate portraits you will see of an immigrant family, and a very, very on-the-ground look at some of the most wrenching poverty in America.
And this, you know, I think this is an important point, and you have said these are, in writing about these people, these indigenous people who came from Oaxaca to do farm work, I think you, in one interview, referred to them as the Brown Okies, because their experience was so much the same as people who had come before, say, to California, but from elsewhere in the United States, and that this story, you said, really challenged your ideas about immigration.
That's right.
As you looked at the ways that farm workers reached into Mexico That is, California farmers are reaching into Mexico looking for workers, and then these people get here, and then they owe money to smugglers, and they, you know, have to pay their rent for substandard housing, and they have to try to take care of themselves. And then, in fact, it may have been the case that people in the past, you know, like your grandfather, could come here and could do it and could make it. But there are serious doubts about whether these people, the experience that they would have, could be anything like that.
That's right.
And whether they would be able to raise themselves out of this kind of crushing poverty in which they find themselves.
Yeah, I think the dream of California remained the same over those 85 years. What brought that woman to California was the same thing that brought my grandfather. The promise, though, it changed. My grandfather had to work 5 years in the fields alongside his mother and brother and sister. They pooled enough money to buy a 20-acre vineyard west of Fresno. That Oaxacan woman, no matter how resourceful she was, no matter how good she was at pinching pennies, could never hope in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years to buy 20 acres of California land. So the promise had changed. How it challenged my views of immigration was this. I went in, thinking that that these were the hardest working people in America, and that never changed. But the equation did change. When you looked at them bringing over their whole families here, women crossing the border pregnant so their child could be born here and be a citizen, the social costs, the hospital costs, the medical costs, the social service costs that were incurred here in America, it really raised the question about, we were bringing a whole peasant class of people here to pick fruits and vegetables, and I wondered if it was penciling out for America, if from a just strictly economic standpoint. And so the piece is a very complicated piece that poses these questions. And what I try to do in my writing is this. I always try to be present. I want the reader to know where I stand at the beginning of a narrative. And I want the reader to see how what I'm seeing may be changing my viewpoint. I'm always trying to challenge my viewpoint. I declare my viewpoint at the beginning, okay? And it may be liberal, it may be in the middle, wherever you see it. But by the end of the narrative, you can then see how the conditions on the ground have changed. And so there's a subjectiveness to the journalism, but I also think in that subjectiveness is an honesty, a kind of narrative honesty. I'm not an automaton, and so I write a lot from the first person, and I tell my own family story. I tell the story of my grandfather, for instance, in this story of the Oaxacans.
We're down to having about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. In the prologue, you write that as a reporter that you worked to find the truth and the lie of the California myth. So tell me, in what way did you find some of each?
Well, we are a mythical place. Our Sierra, our farm belt, our prisons are the biggest prisons in America. And when you look at California, you will see that almost in many, many measures, it's a singular place. It's the biggest, the most daring, bold experiments of, human kind of existence are done out here. So we are a mythical place. And yet, so much of the myth I was trying to work past, the myth that your part of the country in the East kind of hold about California, it's a hard place to understand without turning it into these myths that are kind of more digestible to be able to tell stories. So I found that we were this land of great opportunity for some people. That myth of being able to reinvent yourself by coming west, it was still strong, and it still worked. There was a man that I saw, that I deal with at the beginning of the book, called, his name is Stuart Resnick, a Jewish kid from Highland Park, New Jersey, leaves New Jersey in the 50s. His father is a drunk and a gambler. He comes west to go to law school at UCLA. He's a millionaire while he's still in law school. Today, he is kind of the new king of California. He owns 140,000 acres of California farmland. He grows more pomegranates, pistachios, and almonds than anyone in the world. he and his wife developed this drink called Palm Wonderful. They've actually made the pomegranate into some shishi drink, you know what I mean? And he owns Telefloral, he owned the Franklin Mint, he owns Fiji Water. So this guy's an industrial giant who, from his mansion, and it's an incredible mansion in Beverly Hills, runs this farming empire in the interior. So for him, the California dream obviously happened. For that Oaxacan family, it's a whole other dream. And they exist in these kind of parallel universes. These people are working his fields.
You talked earlier about, you said something like, you know, California is America before the rest of America figures can figure out what it is.
Yeah.
And it seems that in a lot of ways, good and bad, California is a trendsetter. Does California, looking at life in California now, say anything about what the rest of America is going to be like in the next, I don't know, decade?
Well, I think it's going to be interesting how we come out of this bust right now. I think, you know, the way we come out of it, good or bad, may be a lesson for the rest of the country. And so that's the last part of the experiment that I think still needs to play out. We'll see what happens. It's you know, but it is this place that I think that, you know, kind of is writ large in America, and we'll see. It's a very, very troubling time right now out here, and I'm not sure Schwarzenegger. that we never got into Schwarzenegger.
Well, unfortunately, we'll have to leave it at that. There are a lot of good stories in the book. It's The West of the West by our guest Mark Arax, A-R-A-X, the spelling on his last name, if you're going to look for the book. Public Affairs is the publisher. He's a former senior writer at the L.A. Times. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure being with Illinois. Thank you very much.